Okay, so I'm going to follow on the talks we've heard this morning, and I'm going to focus on the question of trying to detect gamma ray emission from the galactic halo due to annihilation of supersymmetric particles. So the I think one of the sub-themes of this meeting has been the idea of testing the Kolb-Lagmar theory. And I think it's a very appropriate place to be having such a discussion, because in fact the Kolb-Lagmar theory was born here in a workshop like this, a program like this, 25 years ago, organized by Mark Davies and Simon White. And this was the birthplace of the theory, although I was actually engendered somewhere else, up the road, mostly in Berkeley, with a little bit of help from Princeton as well, and other places. And I spent all my life working on Kolb-Lagmar, and the attitude then, which is still my attitude today, was let's try and work out what the theory predicts so that we can actually rule it out against observations. And so I'm always amazed, coming back 25 years later to Santa Barbara, to find the theory still here. If I bet how long the theory was going to last, I would have bet maybe 6 months or a year. So, but my attitude is still the same. The goal is to try and rule out the theory. In that sense, I guess my career has been a failure. So now, it's of course very interesting to test the theory against the microwave background radiation, the galaxy distribution, the properties of the Milky Way. But really, there is an ultimate test, which is obviously go find the bloody thing. And until we find the dark matter, I think the sort of confidence that's built up in the community that is the right theory should be maybe it's a bit exaggerated. At any rate, so as we heard today, one of the ways in which we can carry out this ultimate test is through possible detection of the annihilation radiation. We've seen this formula before, and the particle physics is included in the cross-section, and I'm going to normalize that out. I'm going to take that to be 1, focus really on the astrophysics, which is incorporated in the density structure of the dark matter halo, which we can now calculate quite accurately with high-resolution N-body simulations. Julio already showed this picture, and the first thing I'm going to focus on the substructures. First thing I'm going to do is count how there are. And in fact, in this, which is the largest Aquarius simulation, there are 300,000 such substructures. And here is the mass function, number of substructures, function of mass. The different curves here correspond to the different levels of resolution. And something that must be emphasized very strongly is that you shouldn't believe any numerical work unless you're shown convergence tests like this one, because that tells you what you can believe and where the properties that you're interested in have actually converged. And so here we know where our results are converged, and this mass function has a power law form with a slope slightly less than minus 2. Minus 2 is, of course, the critical slope that divides the regime in which most of the mass is in small structures from the regime in which most of the mass is in large structures. And the results that we have are actually on the side that indicates that, in fact, most of the mass is in large substructures, not in small substructures, and because we are on the safe side of minus 2. And so that's shown here, multiplied by the mass squared, just to increase the dynamic range. So this is the same plot, but multiplied by m squared. And if this line was a straight line, then the distribution of mass would be logarithmically divergent. You would have equal amounts of mass in each logarithmic interval. And in fact, the fact it's going down tells us the mass function is convergent towards small scales. And that's important. Now, you can characterize the structures by their Vmax, their circular velocity, and what happened to my other plot? There it is. And here is a similar plot, but now the cumulative distribution as a function of Vmax. And as Piero indicated, the Via Lactea 1 predicts fewer structures, a factor of 3, fewer than we have in our 6 simulations. The Via Lactea 2, which is the dotted line here, is still a little bit low compared to our 6 simulations, only about 30% low or so. And but going back to Scott's comments in the first time, his introductory talk, these differences with Via Lactea 2 are completely immaterial insofar as the problem of the gamma ray annihilation is concerned. So the reasons that Michael and us disagree It's nothing to do with the dark matter. We pretty much agree on the number of substructures. The difference arises from the way in which we calculate the gamma ray emission from these substructures. Now, one crucial aspect is the spatial distribution of these subhalos, and that's shown here. That's just the number, the spatial, the number density function of radius normalized to the mean number of each population for halos of different mass. Here, the colors indicate different masses. 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7, and so on, 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10. And a remarkable result is that the spatial distribution of these subhalos is independent of mass. They all have the same shape. And to appreciate what this means better, here we show the cumulative or the enclosed number fraction of substructures of different mass in a linear log plot. So that the integral under this curve tells you the total number of substructures out to some radius r. And what you can see here very clearly is all the substructures are in the outer parts. All the, the substructures are all at beyond the virial radius, 300, 400 kiloparsecs. Inside 100 kiloparsecs, there is a very small number of substructures. And interior to the solar radius, there's hardly any substructure at all. So the subhalos are far from the sun. And the reason for this is to do with dynamical friction and with tidal stripping. And I'll elaborate upon this in a minute. However, this regularity allows us to extrapolate our results, because one of the, as Michael indicated, Kulin, one of the important issues here is what happens below the resolution of the simulations. Aquarius has enormous resolution, but we're still a mere 10 orders of magnitude away from resolving the free streaming mass in the cold dark matter power spectrum, which may occur at an Earth mass of about 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. So here's, but we understand the physics. We understand dynamic friction. We understand tidal stripping, and that is the relevant physics. So here you see the mass fraction in subhalos as a function of the cutoff mass in the CDM power spectrum, which plausibly as an Earth mass. And if you ask, well, what is the mass fraction interior to 400 kiloparsecs? And here the different curves correspond to the different resolution simulations. Then you find that if you extrapolate with the power law that we believe is correct, only about 20% of the mass inside 400 kiloparsecs is in substructures. But even if you extrapolate using the critical slope of minus 2, that doesn't make much of a difference, less than a factor of 2. So this extrapolation doesn't depend critically on the slope. Now, that's inside 400 kiloparsecs. If you ask the same question inside 100 kiloparsecs, now you find, in fact, that the total mass fraction in subhalos is less than 1% inside 100 kiloparsecs. And if you extrapolate with n equals minus 2, it's only 2%. Interior to the solar radius, the substructure mass fraction is less than 0.1%. The halo is very, very smooth inside the solar radius. All the substructure is in the outer parts. Now, let me now turn to the gamma ray aspect. And first of all, we can see from the simple formula that it's just as well, as Julio just showed, that the density has a slope shallower than minus 1.5, because that tells us that the X-ray luminosity converges. And for an NFW profile, 95% of the expected luminosity comes from R max, the radius at which the velocity is maximum, 50% from 0.1 R max. Even with Aquarius, we do not resolve 0.1 R max, but for a smooth halo, we have this simple scaling that Piero Madao put forward, and we're going to use that to compute the gamma ray emission from substructures. So we're interested in Vmax and Rmax, and something that's absolutely crucial is to understand where the values for these quantities are converged, and that we are the only group that has carried out these convergence tests, because we have simulations, as Julio showed, where as we increase the resolution, we can match the subhalos from one resolution to another. That's what you need in order to be able to do these absolutely vital tests. And so we've done convergence tests on Vmax and Rmax, and here are the relevant plots. The results are that from these rigorous convergence tests, we know that our simulations have converged values of Vmax to 1.5 kilometers per second and converged values of Rmax to 165 parsecs. And these are, of course, much smaller than the values for of the halos in fair for even the faintest dwarf galaxies. So these simulations resolve accurately, reliably, and robustly substructures which are much, much smaller than those that host the ultra-faint dwarfs. Now, the results I'm going to talk about will come out in paper in Nature in November. Here are the authors. Some of the other results I showed out in another paper, both with Springle as first author, since he's the one who has been carrying out all these amazingly high-quality simulations. Now, to calculate the gamma ray luminosity, we need to understand the emission from four components. First, the smooth emission from the main halo. Then the smooth emission from the resolved subhalos. Then the emission from unresolved subhalos. We saw that the simulations resolve only to 10 to the 5 solar masses, and the cut of stream might be 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. We need to account for that. And also the emission from the substructure of the subhalos. Now, the first two are easy to calculate. Here's a plot that shows various quantities as a function of radius. And here's radius, here's 100 kiloparsecs, here's the solar radius. These various quantities normalized to the values at M200. So here's the main halo mass, and you can see that the half mass radius, half the mass of the NFW, of the halo, is actually outside 100 kiloparsecs, half is inside 100 kiloparsecs. At the solar radius, there's only about 3% of the mass of the whole halo interior to the solar radius. Here is the luminosity from the smooth main halo, and that's, of course, much more centrally concentrated than the mass, at the rho squared effect. The half light radius is 2.5 kiloparsecs. Now, these lines show the luminosity from the smooth part of the subhalos. And you can see this for difference of halo masses, greater than 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5. Now, what you see is that this is much more extended than the luminosity from the main halo, because, as I said before, all the substructures are in the outer parts. So their emission is much more extended. Here, the half luminosity radius of these is about 100 kiloparsecs. Now you can see a reflection of that plot I showed earlier, indicating that the radial distribution is independent of mass. That's reflected here in the fact that all these curves have the same shape. And we know why. It's tidal stripping. And so we can now extrapolate 10 orders of magnitude, assuming that these distributions would be the same. It's an extrapolation. But we are encouraged to extrapolate because we know the shape of these curves look very similar, and we can work out the rate at which this luminosity is increasing as we decrease the halo mass. So if we extrapolate to an Earth mass, you'll have a green curve up here, and this green curve will influence the boost factor. The boost factor we calculated by doing this extrapolation would be about 200 if you were looking at the galaxy from outside. But of course, we're not outside the galaxy, we're inside the galaxy. And what we want to know is what does this luminosity, enclosed luminosity, look like interior to the solar radius. And then this green line extrapolated goes to the solar radius at roughly this amplitude. The boost factor is only about a factor of 2. Right, so we've dealt with the smooth emission from the main halo, the smooth emission from the resolved subhalos, and I've told you how we extrapolate beyond what we can resolve in the simulations. The last question is, what is the emission from the substructures? So let me tell you a little bit about substructures. So here's a plot of the Aquarius simulation, and we've selected here six halos that we show amplified here. You can see that the subhalos have themselves substructure, and we, in fact, resolve four generations of substructure in the simulations. Now, the question is, do the substructures look just like scaled-down versions of the big halo? You can see almost by eye, I'll show you the numbers in a minute, that the answer is no. If you look at this halo, as I've been saying, in the inner parts it's very smooth, all the substructures are in the outer parts. This fellow. It's been inside orbiting for a while. It's been tidally stripped of all its big substructures. And in the outer parts here is relatively smooth. This is clearly not a scaled-down version of this object because of tidal stripping. And we can look at that quantitatively. And here's a plot that shows the number of substructures. So when I'm counting now these substructures, substructures, as a function of the mass of the substructure. So it's the number of subs, that's a function of the mass of the substructure. And that's these red points here. That's the number of substructures, function of the mass of the containing substructure. Now, if the situation was self-similar, as I've drawn here, this is self-similar in the sense that the small halos are just scaled-down versions of the big halo, then we can work out how many substructures we should have measured, and that's given by the black circles. So for every red circle, there's a black circle, which is the number of substructures that we should have found if the distribution was self-similar. And as you can see, some look self-similar, but the majority of the red points are below the black points, indicating that the distribution is not self-similar, is not a fractal. And you can see that here, where, again, same information in a different way, where we plotted here the cumulative number of sub-sub-halos within sub-halos, and the different colors are, again, the different resolutions. So these results are converged. We know where they converge compared to the results for the main halo. Now, some of these sub-halos look like the self-similar are self-similar. These are the ones that are just coming in and have not been tidally stripped. The ones that have been around for a while have lost a lot of the substructure, and so they don't look, they have far fewer substructures than their scaled-up versions. And all that's going on here, and I apologize for making such a simple plot, but many of the people in the subject have missed this crucial point. All that's going on here is tidal stripping. I have an object here, and as it comes in, we've seen most of the substructure in the other parts, they get tidally stripped. So that is the tidal radius. This fellow here will have no substructure because it's all been tidally stripped. This has just come in. It's beginning to lose its stuff. And as things orbit, they lose all their substructures and they become much smoother than their counterparts that are still waiting to fall in. So that is the principle that we use. Well, let me just say, so just to reiterate this, the substructure, the distribution of dark matter is not a fractal. It's not subsimilar, and that is because of this tidal truncation augmented by the fact that whereas the main halo keeps being replenished by new info, the halos that have the misfortune of having fallen in, they don't get replenished by anything. On the contrary, as time goes by, even their own substructures lose mass and may eventually merge. That's what you need in order to calculate the emission from the substructure of the subhalos. We essentially just assume that all the material beyond the tidal radius is removed, and once you assume that, then you can scale your results to the main halo to compute the amount of luminosity that you expect from the substructure. So here are the results, and what's plotted here is the signal to noise, the flux divided by the noise, by the area, and for various components, normalized to the signal to noise of the main halo. Okay, so we've taken the particle physics out. We're just referring everything to the signal-to-noise to the main halo, for the main halo. Now, these are the main subhalos in red, and you can see that the main subhalos are 1%, have 1% the signal-to-noise of the main halo, even the biggest ones. That's the red. The blue are the sub-subhalos, and I just argued that they are not important, and indeed, you can see here the signal-to-noise is down 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. So the sub-sub-halos are completely relevant. The boost factor is completely relevant. Yes, Andre, I'm nearly done. These are the known satellites. We don't have SEWE here because when we wrote this paper last spring, we didn't know any much about SEWE. Even the LMC, which we say is the brightest of the sub-halos, is still, in fact, has a lower signal-to-noise than dark substructures. So what we would expect GLASS to see for a uniform background, and the background is uniform, not uniform, Michael very clearly explained the complications, for a uniform background, or even a background that's not uniform but that we understand, we expect most of the emission to be coming from the central part of the galaxy, of, and then the subhalos with a signal-to-noise much smaller than that. The ones, interestingly, they have the highest signal-to-noise, are actually smaller than the subhalos that host the LMC. So GLASS should first see the center. Then, if it's lucky, we get lucky, it should see gamma ray emission coming from places where there are no satellites, and only then it'd be able to see the visible satellite. So let me then conclude. I know Michael Cullen doesn't like this plot. He's told me. I don't want to irritate Michael, but I hope he'll forgive me for this. I want to dispel 5 myths about the galactic halo and annihilation signal from the Milky Way. Myth 1, the halo dark matter is mostly in small Earth mass clumps. We've seen that that's not true. The halo dark matter is self-similar. It's a self-similar distribution of nested substructure, maybe a fractal. That's not true. Most of the substructure is in big objects. Small Earth mass clumps dominate the observable signal. The particle physics boost factor, irrelevant in the Milky Way. Dwarf spheroidals of subhalos are the best targets for detecting the signal. Not true. Of course, you should look there. Naturally, everybody's going to look there. But you expect, if you can deal with the backgrounds, to see the center coming through, booming out first. And finally, I've said this now twice, or 3 times, or 10 times, but particle physicists don't always listen. This boost factor, forget about it, is not important at all for the Milky Way. And I'll stop here.
So we'll take a couple of questions for Carlos and Julio, and then we'll open the floor for discussion of all 4 talks. So,
Carlos, do you understand why you obtained different radio distribution of massive subhalos from the G-halo simulation?
I haven't examined the G-halo simulation, and. So the ones, I'm not even sure they know. I mean, I don't know if they calculated that, but the ones we can compare with are the Via Lactea, and I think Michael can speak, but I don't think we disagree. I think the radial distribution of subhalos should be the same. Now, of course, you have to bear in mind that 2 important things when people compare Sarah Palin against Joe Biden, right? The sexes are different. Now here, one thing to understand about the difference between Via Lactea 2 and Aquarius is that, as Julio showed, there's quite a lot of variation from one halo to another. So there are 2 big differences between Via Lactea 2 and Aquarius. I don't know about G-halo because I haven't seen that, but well, I've seen a paper, but it's very short. Now, firstly, we have 3 times better resolution than they do, and that, of course, is going to affect the substructures. You need to not the massive halos, but it will affect the radial distribution of structures. But the main thing that I didn't say, and I'll say it now, is that as Julio showed, there's a whole range of, there's a distribution of properties. In particular, the concentration of that Aquarius halo, there's the distribution of concentrations, and just by luck, we picked a halo which is 1 sigma of the mean in concentration, whereas Michael and colleagues picked a halo which is at the other end of the distribution, also 1 sigma. So the 2 halos are very different in concentration. And that, of course, will affect dynamical friction and tidal stripping. So I don't think that the simulations differ. I have no reason why they should differ when you take into account the sort of cosmic scatter. So I don't think we have a problem with the dark matter.
The prediction of the dark matter. The cosmology that has not been set, right? We use WMAP3, so we have a power slope of 0.95 and sigma 8 of 0.74. They use sigma 8 of 0.96, 0.9, and a slope of n equal 1. So 0.9. WMAP.
But we have discussed with the referees of our papers extensively, whom you know extremely well.
I wasn't the referee.
I know. It was Jack Diemann here. I don't know why we cannot agree on this, but the value of sigma 8 doesn't make any difference. The slope of the power spectrum might. I would agree with that, but sigma 8 is completely irrelevant.
Well, we don't agree because there is a simulation by Macho et al. That claims that, in fact, it does make a difference in the field halos, and you guys instead provide, feelings.
The point is, I think those differences are small compared to the fact that we just sample different parts of the concentration distribution. I think that is the dominant difference between them. The other ones are details.
I also wanted to comment that it's not necessarily important if you select.
Sounds like Michael. Yeah. Where is Michael? Right.
You guys always are selecting by mass, but as I was trying to show, that's not necessarily what's most relevant, especially if you're talking about annihilation. Maybe you should be selecting by, the annihilation luminosity itself, or by at least something that is less affected by tidal stripping. So that definitely affects the radial distribution.
But we're not selecting, you know, we're selecting all the clumps that we have there, and we're actually, when we come to compute the gamma ray luminosity, we use the Vmax and the Rmax. We don't, the mass doesn't play a role.
Right, right. But just if you're describing radial dependencies, then it does matter how you select.
So. Well, sure. I was just showing. Right. I showed a, yes. I agree with that. But I showed a plot for that particular the radial distribution of subhalos of different mass. I could do the same for subhalos of different Vmax.
Right. But and I think
actually,
it would have a different.
I bet you we would agree. I don't see how we cannot
agree. I agree that we would agree. But it's more important. It matters what you're showing, what you're emphasizing. You know, if you're talking about annihilation, you shouldn't be selecting by mass because you're stripping mass away from the outer regions, but that's not what's relevant for the annihilation. Pores are more important.
Of course, Michael, we completely agree with that, but that the mass has never come into the calculation of the annihilation.
The question is the Vmax function self-similar?
No. What do you mean by self-similar?
When you do the Vmax function of subhalos,
well, I show you
the mass function.
I show the Vmax function as well.
Subs of
I
subs.
Show both.
Okay.
So let me show you that one.
Okay.
If I can find it.
While you're showing it, I'll make the comment I was gonna.
Okay, but because then I cannot listen to your comment.
Okay.
Let me just find it first.
One thing at a time.
Yeah, exactly. One thing that I learned theorists are very good at is doing one thing at a time. I think it's probably the easiest. There you go. So that's.
But are those subhalos though? That's what I was asking.
Somebody was asking about this.
I wonder whether that might be part of the difference between VL2 and what you're finding because they were doing Vmax functions.
No, I think the difference between VL2 and us. It depends on what? On the gamma ray?
No.
I know what the difference is. The difference in the gamma ray predictions comes from the fact that the way in which we give gamma ray luminosity to the subhalos. And as Michael said, in this paper he published, he didn't take into account the fact that the substructures are in the other parts.
I still don't
understand another aspect of his analysis, but I think that's the main difference.
Okay,
do you agree with that, Michael?
I was actually asking about the self-similar Vmax function of substructure.
Uh-huh.
Whether that looks different than the self-similar that you show that the mass function of substructure is not self-similar.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering whether if you did it in Vmax, you might see something closer to self-similar because the subhalos are more mass is hard to define is the main point.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, that wasn't my question. Let me ask it really fast. So the
Well, I have the answer, but let's
see. James might ask my question.
Okay. So I think this issue of boost, I mean, if I had to guess, I think you're right. The boost probably doesn't matter. But if you talk about tidal stripping, I mean, if you're looking at objects that are 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, I don't see a really strong physical reason as to why they shouldn't trace something more closely to the global profile of the system. You know, I understand that you're not seeing a trend in mass, but at some level, very, very low mass substructure has to be more centrally peaked than higher mass substructure.
No.
Because it's harder to disrupt them. I mean, if you just do the scaling, I mean, you...
Actually, that's exactly my question. I guess I just don't understand why you're making this argument. I mean, that there's all to say the 10 to the minus 6 substructures will be in the very outer regions. I mean, Carlos and I talked about this ad nauseum maybe a month ago, but I mean, I just want you to clarify like why you guys think this is happening.
It's just that
we're making an extrapolation, so we're not going to be able to justify it beyond that. The extrapolation is based on the fact that we see in the simulations that the radial distribution does not depend on mass or on velocity once you go below, you know, the most massive subhalos. And the reason we think for that is the fact that once you're below, you'd say, a thousandth of the mass of the main halo, the mass is irrelevant, right? All these are test particles moving in this potential. Dynamic friction timescales are so long that it doesn't matter if you're one thousandth or one ten-thousandth of the mass. Now we extrapolate. And we extrapolate. So either you believe us or you don't believe us. But
you could be right. But even if you look at your figure, you're going to the less massive subhalos, like down to the 10 to the 5s, if you show that figure that you had in your paper. Like, you're clearly getting more emission from the central regions. I mean, granted, it's not as much as the rho squared. It's never going to be. But
yeah,
actually, keep going back.
Yeah, so where did he go? Sorry, it's the previous plot.
So basically the point is, like, why, I mean, I don't understand the argument that, the say, the 10 to the minus 6 green line will not line up something more like the blue line.
You have to agree that
please speak one person at a time, because otherwise it's chaos. And I think at this point it sounds like discussion sort of opens up towards questions to both, to all four speakers. So maybe, like, Mike, Pierre is here, Julio. So if you cluster in one place, then it's easier to pass the mic, but you can ask questions to all of them.
Let me just answer the question. So, you know, this is the data we have, okay? So Julio said you have to extrapolate. You extrapolate on the basis of what you have. What we have is these curves all look very similar, and that when you extrapolate, you have to really change this distribution very dramatically in order to come through the solar radius at anywhere not near this red line.
But you are assuming something about the concentration of really, really low mass stuff.
Right. I'm not assuming anything. I'm just extrapolating.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that...
which is the same.
You're assuming the concentration is a mass relation, is a power law down to 10 to the minus 6 solar mass.
I'm just assuming that these curves stay the same shape, and that the rate at which this is the gamma ray luminosity is changing as the mass changes stays the same. So, and it's very flat. So that's what we're assuming. So.
I'd like to ask a question about the difference in the simulations in another way. Mm-hmm. Let's assume it's 5 years after Fermi flies, and no signal is detected.
Right.
Whose fault is it?
Well, do you lay the blame at the foot of the particle physicists?
No.
Do you put it at the blame in the astrophysics? And to what degree is the difference between what both of you are doing at the foot?
What happens with LHC, for example? If the LHC finds some evidence for a supersymmetric particle, then that makes it much harder to, you know, wiggle out of it by saying the cross-section is much lower and the mass is much higher.
Yeah, if LHC doesn't see anything, it could be because the cross-section is lower, and it could be because cold dark matter is strong. It could be warm dark matter, it could be less power, less air. But it's not going to be the two. It's nothing to do with the simulation.
I mean, Leo, what you have to realize, you ask the particle physicists about the.
So you're convinced that the astrophysics is okay. Is what I'm hearing you saying.
I'm convinced that we have enough understanding of the clumpiness on the scale that are relevant. But I'm worried about the extrapolation, and that's where we'd be.
But the astrophysics is better than the particle physics.
Yes.
I'm convinced that the astrophysics is much better than the particle physics.
So, I don't think we disagree.
And if we had some particle physicists in the room, would they agree?
Can I just
make a comment about this plot?
While I carry mic to the particle physicist, James can ask a question.
Can I just make a comment about this plot while we move on? I think this may actually be something Michael showed, but here you're binning things by mass. I'd be interested to see it binned by boost. So, you know, what you may be seeing here is just, okay, you're measuring mass at some point, things are getting stripped in a certain way. As you've said many times, there's a huge scatter in concentration at fixed mass. So it'd be interesting to see what the radial distribution of things of a fixed, you know, concentration or physical density within some small scale is.
Michael and I do not disagree on the boost either. So he said the boost was 200.
Okay, so from his plots, I would gather that actually the most concentrated things are, extend much more to small radii, and that therefore, you know, the extrapolation is not as obvious there.
Forget about the boost, but there's another instance when you can forget about the boost, even if everything that Carlos is saying is right, which is the cosmological gamma ray background, because you're sensitive to the entire. Exactly, but you again didn't say it this time that the boost does matter for some things, even if it doesn't matter for individual subhalos within the Milky Way. It will make a difference if you're asking about the total extrapolation throughout all of structural formation throughout cosmic history.
I mean, you're detecting gamma rays within the galaxy. You will not see an NFW profile. You would see the substructures, which are in the outer parts, boosted by a factor of 200. So when I say the boost factor is relevant, I mean for galactic detection. And actually, Michael, we have the same number, right? You said 2, which is a number I have as well, and you said 200, which is a number I have as well. So actually, I don't think that's where we disagree.
So, since I'm the closest to a particle physicist in the audience, I'm not a particle physicist anymore, but in terms of the particle physics models, they are not created equal in terms of the annihilation rate into gamma rays. So we won't necessarily know from the LHC immediately or from direct detection immediately what kind of model class we are speaking of. We have basically four model classes, one where what we call the bulk and the focus point regions, the funnel and the co-annihilation. That's some kind of nomenclature that I could explain tomorrow. But the and two of those give strong annihilation signals, and two of those are very depressed.
Are depressed. Suppressed.
Yes. It's not true that because you have a the annihilation cross section gives a relic density that you have a constant annihilation cross section in gamma rays now. Okay. We are at very low temperature now. At the time of the relic density, the temperature was much higher, and therefore P wave annihilation could proceed, for instance, and it does not proceed very well now, and things like that.
Yeah, no, Bernard, but you would agree, though, that if you take the simplest supersymmetric models, and they may be wrong, but if you take the simplest supersymmetric models, then even though there is an uncertainty, as you say, in the cross-section, nevertheless, glass stands a chance. So it's in the right ballpark.
I do believe that the glass is a very important input to the understanding the whole problem.
Yeah, but it could actually detect it. I mean, it does have a chance. So the kind of cross sections that to which glass is sensitive are not crazy cross sections.
Yeah, no, they are not. They are not. Now, I still have a problem understanding where you are, where you differ.
Well, you what?
I think one way, let me say this, one way we disagree with them is that they claim that the diffuse signal from the...
Yeah, I'll speak in the mic.
Pass the mic.
Oh, sorry.
I thought I was speaking loudly enough, but...
It's for recording,
they,
not for
yeah. They claim that the smooth signal can also be detected. Now, that assumes that either the background is uniform or it is known extremely well. We think that it's going to be extremely difficult to subtract the background that, in fact, as Michael showed, swamps the signal all over. It's going to be extremely difficult to subtract it at a level that then what is left, you're sure, is the diffuse emission. And it's much easier to look at subclumps or the dwarf galaxies where you can, you have a few pixels and then you remove the background near that clump and then what is left is the signal. So, that's another difference in the astrophysics. It's going to be easier to detect subclumps or the smooth component at 10 degrees away from the galactic center.
So that is a question of observational strategy.
That's right.
But do you agree numerically or not?
In signal to noise, yes.
You do.
But sort of. I mean, only when you take into account the different concentrations of the halos. But I completely disagree with Piero, because what glass has that EGRET didn't have is energy discrimination. So I think they could do a very good job of subtracting the background. Even if they don't, in our Nature paper, in the supplementary information, we followed Michael's analysis of coming in a more complicated background. And it changes the signal to noise of the main halo by about a factor of 10. But remember, it was already 100 times bigger than the nearest substructure, which is a dark substructure. And so I think the principle is still there, but I think one should have hope that, in fact, glass will be able to subtract the background much better than Michael can do just using EGRET because of the energy discrimination. I'm sure Michael would agree with that.
I wanted to ask Julio a question that isn't about annihilation, if that's okay. I can wait until later if there's... So you showed these really amazing radial profiles of the dark matter halo density and also the velocity dispersion anisotropy. And at least in the case of the halo structure, the density profile, there appears to be, in some cases, 1 or 2% deviations from the mean fit. And presumably these are statistics.
Poisson error distribution is, right? So basically these are, in other words, you know, we have a billion particles, right? So I should be able to estimate the density, you know, at a particular, you know.
But there are but if you look in two nearby radial bins, for instance, I mean, there appears to be a slight shape mismatch in some cases. Is that?
I'm not exactly sure what you're saying.
Okay, well, it's hard to say. We don't have the plot, so yeah, maybe we should talk later. I'm just wondering, deviations from spherical symmetry, or how much does this play, or these kind of effects
many
play?
Many of the things that catch the eye are substructures, which have not been removed. If you remove the substructures, everything becomes a lot smoother, but the main trends still remain. I mean, remember that there is not more than about 10% of mass in substructures, so they can't change any of these trends, but they will change, you know, little blips in the profiles. Very center. We should talk about it.
Okay, so the line should get you cold. Let's hang all the speakers.